Welcome to the inaugural show zero of the Babylon podcast. My name is Summer Brooks.
I'm going to put that on and go into the spot factory and get to work.
My dog and I are being attacked by a duck.
I think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
The virgin sits on a crate, opening and closing his pipe.
Steph has a mind of its own tonight.
I didn't get any entries at all.
Telepaths against mundanes is no contest.
I like Day of the Dead.
I did too.
Hey guys, it's Gary. I'm listening to episode 1.
And God help us all, this is Joe Truman. Production of the malt liquor beverage Zima.
Nice and close, and I looked at him like, oh, do you want?
Hey there. Okay, I'm... Actually, let me call you back. Bye.
Summer, I knew it was a bad idea to record. I knew it was.
And welcome back to another Babylon podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
Let the Zima flow. It's Jeffrey in Los Angeles. And that's the cue for Brett.
That's the cue for Brett. I thought you were going to introduce me today, but I'll introduce myself. I'm Brett, and I'm in the studio today with Mike.
Yep, that'd be me.
And we have two special guests joining us today. Somewhere out there in cyberspace, we have two members of a band, a rock and roll sci-fi geek band called Sci-Fried. We have Jim and Chuck with us, hiding out
there.
That's
right.
This is Jim.
We also have Sonny, the bass player, with us, too.
All right.
Three. Buy two, get one free. I like this.
Was that buy two fried, get one free?
Sure, why not?
Right.
Hopefully people remember a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, we mentioned Sci-Fried had a Babylon 5 parody song out there because I put out the call saying I want more Babylon 5 parody because you can never get enough. And sure enough, one of our listeners came up with For Whom Babylon Tolls, which was just awesome.
That is awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on the show. Before we start asking you some questions about Sci-Fried, I do want to make an announcement. I'm sure by now everybody has heard the news, but we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the passing of Andrew Koenig, Walter Koenig's son. And, of course, Walter played Bester as a recurring role on Babylon 5. And apparently it was a suicide due to depression, and our thoughts and best wishes go out to the Koenig family.
Yep.
Yes, absolutely. Indeed.
No, sad thing. And if I may add this, because not everybody knows about Andrew, but if you have the opportunity and you can search your Google videos or however you find your stuff online, you'll find, if you search for Batman Dead End, search for Batman Dead End, there's a small short film that Andrew plays the Joker, and he did an amazing job with it. Really kind of
realized that was him.
It is. And that's such a great piece. I think it's one of the best Batman characters ever. You know, I mean, it's the truest to the comic books as far as I'm concerned. But it's a great example of the kind of work that Andrew was capable of doing. So.
Yeah, too young, too quick, brother.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's true.
So now what was the big, whose idea was it to try to mix sci-fi and rock and roll in the same sentence?
That would be us. It just seemed natural for us.
Okay.
So were you guys science fiction fans first or rock and rollers first? Or was it just...
Little of both, but I met Jim going to sci-fi conventions, and our love of, you know, the conventions and music kind of just melded together into Sci-Fried, starting with the parodies, you know, like something like the Babylon 5 song, and then into making our own originals.
The one thing that I noticed listening to the CDs that you guys graciously sent out, usually when you think of sci-fi fandom and music, you think folk, which is more of a folky kind of thing. You guys are definitely a metal band. Do you guys stand out in the crowd that way, or are there more guys doing the kind of stuff that you're doing?
Well, it's there's a few other guys, you know, like you may have heard of Warp 11, you know, guys like that. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't classify it as heavy metal, but it's just rocking. And, you know, we go all over the place. We have a reggae song and a little bit of rap, but just seem right.
We're trying to bring the geek rock into the scene because I love rock and I'm a geek. And you know, the nerd That's tour true. Is really huge right now. Everybody's listening to nerd rock.
I would never have put the two as a combo, but you know, then again, I would never would have put Jack Daniels and Diet Coke as a combo, but I'm drinking it right now.
You know, like Nerf Herder did it back, you know, when they were doing like the Buffy theme and the Chewbacca song and things like that, but we just want, that's all we'll sing about is anything sci-fi or anything geek, because it's really what we do and what we're all about anyway, so...
The other thing that I noticed, your first disc, first one, which was Geeks Unite, was much more heavy on originals, and then Ramming Speed is much more of the parody kind of stuff. Was that by design, or did that just work out that way?
Kind of worked out that way. We like I said, we started with the parodies with me and Jim. And everyone doing parodies. And so we had these group of songs built up from all our parodies, and we decided to release them the same time we released all our originals, because the other one is all originals.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like a little bit of both. That's how we started, and we had them, and so many people liked them. You know, like the Babylon 5 song, and we have Stargate and everything like that, and we just couldn't hold them back. As much as we love the originals, you know, the parodies, they're great. They're hilarious. I mean, we got in contact with you guys because of them, so we figured why not put them all onto one CD? I mean, there's like 15 parodies on that album.
Yeah. So when you guys are coming up with parodies, what comes first, the inspiration for the alternate lyrics, or does like a particular song you hear on the radio or on your iPod inspire? It's like, hey, wow, this makes me think of Stargator, or this makes me think of Andromeda, or something like that.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Like, Jim had the idea for the Spock song, just listening to the original Twisted Sister song on the radio, and you never know when they're going to strike like that.
Yeah.
Like, that the made Babylon me laugh. 5 song, I kept hearing it, I kept hearing the whole 5 seasons long thing in my head on the radio, and I'm like, I just started writing it, and sometimes they just happen like that.
I mean, maybe it's the alcohol I'm drinking right now, but I mean, I keep listening to this, like the names of songs and the names of albums, and I just keep grinning like this is the coolest combo ever. Because I'm a huge heavy metal fan, but I'm a huge sci-fi fan, and I never thought there was anybody else out there like me.
You're here. That's cool. And we're coming to your town.
That's right. We're here to take over.
Daughters.
I'm gonna have to email Jim offline some parody song ideas that I came up with, but I could never finish the lyrics to. So I will gladly hand them over to people much more gifted at that than I am.
I actually have a couple of parodies in the pocket that we haven't mixed on to put out yet. One's about Indiana Jones. Which is
oh, nice.
Indiana Jones.
Dr. Love.
Right.
So, I mean, I'll ask you, I mean, do you kind of stick to the mainstream sci-fi stuff, or is it like, you know, I mean, really whatever tickles your fancy? I mean, how far back do y'all go?
We'll go anywhere. We got a Monty Python song coming up for our next batch of originals. Everybody, there's 6 of us in the band, and everyone kind of has a different kind of favorite thing, you know? So it really plays into the diversity of everything we can pull out as far as what we're going to sing about, what we're going to, you know, write songs about.
Do you think maybe you guys could do a Babylon 5 Monty Python thing, and it could sort of be like Spamalon 5?
Yeah, that reminds me of I forget which one of the actors did the South Park Babylon 5 crossover.
That was me.
Yeah, that was you. That thing was hilarious. Yeah, something like that.
That's great stuff.
Mix them together.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of irony when you are doing a spoof of Monty Python, which is, just a spoof of life in general. I mean, that's just, you're spoofing a spoof. It's kind of hilarious.
Yeah. It would be a silly song, as they say, yes. To go with this silly walk.
Nice. Very nice.
Okay, and let's hear from Sonny. Sonny, what are you playing there? Are you a Fender jazz kind of guy, or what do you got thumping?
Thunderbird, actually.
Ooh, oh, nice. Listen to you. All right.
Well, that's one. He's got many, many babies in the pocket there.
Ibanez Iceman. I like big, jagged, absurd-shaped guitars.
Yeah. Nice.
We got to get him a stand-up, fretless stand-up.
I'm almost 6'7", so I have to have
You're kind of a big guitar man when you're that tall.
I did recall seeing a local band here in Richmond, and their bassist was this huge guy. He was like 6'7", but 350 pounds, and he was playing. He was playing it was the little. I can't remember the. I want to say the hamburger, but that's not the right name. But it's the little. It was the little
the Steinburger.
Steinburgers. Yeah, no headstock, and I mean, it was just such a weird juxtaposition. It was just so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, when you get that to be that size, if you don't play something that's rather large, it looks like you're playing a ukulele, and that's just not cool to me. No one wants to watch you play a ukulele on the stage.
So when you guys are on stage, do you dress up in uniforms, costumes, or you just show up in your jeans and sneakers?
Well, it depends on the – most of the time we just show up in our jeans and sneakers and our geek attire type shirts, you know. It depends on the setting, you know, but usually we just play the way we play and just dress normal, kind of our geek wear. But there's so much stuff happening around us with costumes. You don't want to look at our costumes. You want to see all the costumes in the crowd.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That totally makes sense.
We'll have a few people that aren't playing, like, in maybe specific costumes for certain songs like that. But now we keep it loose on stage.
Nice. So, is there a certain genre of sci-fi you guys like? I mean, like, if I'd sit there and say, what's your favorite sci-fi show, movie? Like, what got you all hooked on this in the beginning?
I met Jim at a Star Trek convention here in Orlando. And so that was what I got into the conventions with. But I've always liked everything, Star Wars, Babylon 5, Stargate. Pretty much everything they would play on the old Sci-Fi Channel. I don't know about this wrestling stuff, but
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, exactly.
That's my whole life. I used to have to schedule my practices and shows around Star Trek conventions. I used to get ragged on for it. Now I schedule my shows at conventions, so I love it.
Now, you guys just got invited to Star Wars Celebration this year, right?
Yes, for the 501st mixer party.
Nice.
We know a lot of guys in the 501st.
I actually did a song for the 501st.
Really?
Yeah. Not to be confused with the Catalina wine mixer.
Yeah. This is the 501st mixer. They'll have wine too, but...
Very good. Well, gentlemen, we need to take a quick break here before we delve into our deep geeking. So, let's go ahead and do that for a moment, and then we'll come back and we'll tear this sucker apart.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning.
Yes, sir.
How do you like your rock?
JMS wrote a show for TV one day.
Says geeks can't rock. Sci-fried. Get your rock hot. And with more Babylon Podcast, we are here to bring you the deep geeking. The deep geeking, the beginning of the end of the deep geeking, if you think about it.
Which is funny to say that because it's the beginning.
Yes.
Right.
Good point. Right.
That's
in
good.
The beginning is the beginning of the end of the deep geeking because we have finished the main show, the main series, the 5-year arc. We did it. We did the 5-year arc in about 5 years.
We laughed. We cried. Yep. We laughed some more.
And now,
thanks to everybody who stuck with us in all that time.
Really, really.
Mm-hmm.
And to our one faithful listener, whoever you may be in your igloo in Alaska, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Right.
Alaska or in Antarctica?
Whatever.
Okay.
Wherever the penguins are.
Yes, but indeed we are deep geeking on In the Beginning, and this was the first TNT Babylon 5 movie, TV movie commissioned.
Yep.
And I tell you what, you know, it's watching it this time, I really tried to watch it from the point of view of somebody who might have been coming to the show for the first time at the beginning of year 5, because this was basically the story so far. It was the primer to fill in newcomers at TNT who probably never heard of Babylon 5 or failed to catch it. And I have to admit, my efforts to view it that way were entirely unsuccessful.
Okay.
Interesting. It's funny because when I watched it, I never took it as like them trying to introduce people to Babylon 5 because, I mean, the show was over at that point. It was more of a I thought it was more of a – I don't want to say a way to keep the franchise going because I don't think that was it. But I just thought it was a way to sit there and show people who've been watching for 5 years how you got where you got.
No, it was initially designed to be a let's introduce Babylon 5 to the people who watch TNT all the time because they've never heard of this show.
Right. Absolutely. It was the first time that the show was going to be aired nationally at the same time, at the same place, and that the story could begin to unfold for you. And it made perfect sense to do a prequel to set up all the heady stuff that was about to come, as TNT would not only air 5, but am I missing that? TNT ran all of the shows, right?
Yeah.
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 Right.
Yes. That's how I filled in my video collection.
Uh-huh. Well, I got to say, I unlike the previous 200 episodes we've done, I actually did a little research tonight to refresh my memory of what this show was about.
Yeah.
And I saw some of the I saw the trailer that TNT had done and a couple other bits of video that I found online, and I had forgotten how exciting the battle sequences were. And I don't mean to be opening a whole can of worms and taking up your time, but I just remember thinking to myself, I'm not sure that there has ever been a cooler space battle put on television before.
No, I agree. And one of the things that I came away with, again, as a result of my failure to put myself in the shoes of a newcomer, was that indeed the Battle of the Line did get the treatment that it deserved. You know, when you compare it to what we saw in The Sky Full of Stars, you know, it was one or two ships, you know, and the explosions were pretty lame, and it just wasn't – yeah, I mean, it was exciting then because we were caught up in the story because of the mystery that had already been generated by the writing, but this was definitely when you hear Sinclair say, oh, my God, and – then it's the screen full of jump points forming.
Right.
I mean, as far as you could see.
Yep.
Yeah. And it wasn't gratuitous. It was attached to a story of this massive battle that we hadn't experienced in the series for those people who had seen seasons.
That was the genius of it, in my opinion, is how in the heck, I mean, if you ever sat there and thought about J. Michael Straczynski and wondered what the heck goes on in his head, I mean, the fact that he could make this movie that came out after everything was done, the five-year show had run its course.
Well, it hadn't, though. It had the four years.
It was year four, you're right. But, you know, he could sit there and do this and throw this in, and it just worked so well, right? I mean, it answered questions. It wasn't like one of those things with Star Trek where you sit there and you look at it like this doesn't quite fit in the universe.
No, but see, here's the problem. There is some significant retcon going on in this thing.
Oh, yeah.
and even with trying to sit down and try to watch it as somebody who's never seen Babylon 5 before, the fact of the matter is I'd watched it from in the beginning, and there were some significant issues with it that all the Londo stuff makes up for the deficiencies of the retconning.
Yes. Some of the retconning works for me. Some of the retconning doesn't.
Yeah, I was really hoping we were going to bring up those points, honestly, because it does. If you are a huge fan of the show or a true fan of the show, you look at this and like, you know, wait a second, this doesn't quite all fit. But I was willing to let that go. I forgave it because it was a damn good story. I'm sorry, it was a damn good story, and it was well done.
Chuck, how did you find Babylon 5? Did you find it first through TNT? What was your first exposure?
No, I watched it when it was originally with the P10, and it was aired on I forget which local station. And I watched it from the very beginning. And when it switched over, you know, to TNT, I was just glad that it was being continued and that they could finish that fifth year, even though they, you know, did the way they ended the fourth season, whatever. But I thought it was brilliant. It worked out for both of them because TNT knew going in, well, there's only one more season of story. So the prequel idea and all the other movies they did, I thought for a fan was brilliant, you know. Keep it going. I don't know what happened with the Rangers situation. It just seemed to die after that. But
yeah, it did.
That was TNT or what.
Yeah. Okay, so I was just trying to see if maybe we got somebody who the first exposure was in the beginning. I mean, all right, well let's here to me there's two significant issues I have with the retcon. The first of it is all the main characters running into each other in this one particular movie. If you think of Babylon 5 as this planned universe with this huge tapestry of story, with the detail and the richness that went on, you would think that at some point in time in the five-year arc, somebody would have turned to somebody else.
I remember when.
Yeah, right.
Hey, wait, you're that guy. Yeah, I mean, right. Especially something that significant, even if it was 10 years previous, right? You'd sit there and say, wait a second, your face looks kind of familiar.
Right. Yeah, but
that never happened.
Right.
And that was my biggest bitch about the whole thing, to be honest with you, was really, I mean, something this significant like Jakar and Sheridan and Franklin are all down in a shelter that just got bombed. They don't remember this 10 years later. I would remember that we're getting bombed. I'm sorry. Whoever's with me, I remember that.
No. That I could actually forgive. It was the I'm standing on the deck of a Minbari cruiser yelling out another Minbari's dying message. And I don't remember Dr. Franklin or Jakar. What?
Yeah.
That's the biggest problem. The biggest one where I'm like, oh, how big was that shoehorn and how much KY did you use?
It's Crisco.
And see up to that, well, up to about that point, well, I would say up to the point where Sheridan takes out the Black Star, I thought it generally worked. I could handle that Londo and Jakar were working both sides of the street, if you will, on the humans. I get that. Like the introduction of Lieutenant Commander Sheridan, okay? That was good stuff. That was good character stuff. That's what we knew Sheridan would do. No, I don't want this assignment because I don't think that's a good situation for me. But the other thing, and I went and watched this again, I watched Points of Departure again just to refresh my memory. The bit with taking out the Black Star was very much like Han shooting first. in the beginning, the incident is portrayed as an act of desperation.
Yes.
The fleet's been destroyed. The captain's been killed.
It wasn't some massive strategy he came up with.
Right. It's like we've got to survive, and here's what we're going to do. But in Points of Departure, it was clear that it was a strategy. He says,
yes,
everything we tried didn't work. I hit on the idea of mining the asteroid belt. That's not... We were being chased. It was a fight for survival. When you mine the asteroid belt, that's a pretty large swath of space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And one of the things I liked about that original take and Points of Departure is it shows – it lays the groundwork as John Sheridan is a man who does what's necessary strategically so that when it gets to the point that he's – secretly shipping telepaths onto Earth Force cruisers to have them activated by Leda, as shocking as it is, you understand that that's how he thinks.
Well, now, see, I didn't see
three moves ahead.
Yeah, I didn't see those two descriptions of that incident as being that far apart. You know, both of them were, hey, our ship is damaged, we need to call for help, but if
no,
we call for
see, help... the thing is, he didn't say that their ship was damaged in Points of Departure.
That's right.
In Points of Departure, it
he
sounds
said they
very
sent
much
out the distress
like...
signal.
He but said he said you lured them right. in with a fake distress signal.
Right.
He actually said fake?
I'm pretty
no,
sure
he
did.
No, he doesn't say fake, no, but he says lure them in with a... If you listen to how he says it, we threw everything we could at them... Nothing could stop them. I hit on the idea of mining the asteroid field between Jupiter and Mars with proximity fusion bombs. They don't need to lock onto anything. And then we lured them in with a distress signal. That sounds like, what do we do? Well, rockets can't stop it. Bullets can't stop it.
I have an idea.
Right. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I will agree that...
And that's why the Minbari were so upset with him, is because it wasn't an act of desperation. It was cold, calculated thing to do.
Yes.
There was no honor in that.
Yes, I will agree, and that did somewhat bug me, honestly. Yeah. I can't disagree. It was portrayed completely different one point versus the other. And I
right.
would,
and in the beginning, it gets jiggered, so Greedo shoots first.
That's a great way to put it.
I wouldn't say it's that bad.
Yes, it's horrible.
He says we have those nukes, right? We can set those nukes out there because we know they're going to come back when we call for help.
But it was more of a, hey, look, we have to call for help. And if we're going to call for help, it's going to attract attention. And if we're going to attract attention, we might as well sit there and try to take them out with us, as versus saying, I have a great idea. Let's put a fleet of ships behind the asteroid belt, mine the whole thing, send out a bunch of distress signals, and just lure them in constantly. Right? And that's not the way it was portrayed, and at least in the beginning, but that was the way it was portrayed in Points of Departure.
Now, I will say I really loved Sharon's expression when he turns around to talk to Captain Stearns and finds that Captain Stearns has a beam in his brain. There's that, oh, shit.
Oops. Now what?
And the enormity of it hits him. Not only that his captain is dead, but he's in charge now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the coolest part about that shot is the blood clumps floating in
the... Yes, the weightless...
Oh, my goodness. That was like, oh, that's gross. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you on that one. So I will say, outside the retconning, I mean, if you take that out, right, and you just watch it from the how did the Earth Minbari War start, right?
Yeah.
I thought that part really well done.
Yeah.
Oh, and I'll tell you what, the stuff with Londo just made me want to cry again.
Oh, God, I know. God. Don't remind me.
I mean, because that's...
He stole all the great scenes.
He did. He really did. At the very beginning, because I'll tell you guys, I didn't watch this movie today like I wanted to. I didn't have time. I got to see the first probably 10 minutes of it before I came over to the studio tonight. So I got to see the part where Londo starts this whole thing off.
Yeah.
And oh my God, just he had the best parts. He really did. The one thing I wanted to go back to, though, was when the humans and Londo were talking about, hey, we've heard these guys call them Inbari.
Right.
Right. And Londo says, you know, at our best, we never got involved with these guys because we just couldn't compete. And right. I thought to myself, you know, here's the humans who come just right off the Dilgar War, and they're thinking to themselves, they, you know, hey, we've got something to prove. I thought to myself, you know, when Londo said arrogance and stupidity all wrapped up in one little package, how efficient of you guys. I mean, beautiful writing. But what I thought most about that was it was the same thing I would do. Like what you hear about, like if you're going to go to prison, right, and you're the smallest guy in prison, go pick on the biggest guy you can find to sit there and show to everybody else that you're a real tough guy. That's what the humans did. Yeah. And they found out that you picked on the biggest guy in prison, and he kicked the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that,
over the top about it, too, you know, like, that's the biggest joke about, well, we defeated them, you know, the Minbari are just another ship.
They're just another race out there.
Mm-hmm.
It was that cliche military cockiness, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, well, we handle these guys, we can handle those guys. Really not the same even sport, let alone ball field. But right. I mean, but what I loved about that was the arrogance that came out of that. And you got this feeling that the humans were just like, you know, hey, we want to prove to everybody else that we're somebody. And this is how we're going to do it. And boy, did they do that the wrong way.
Yep, they brought a knife to a gunfight.
Totally right, right?
Like, here's the other thing, and after having done this podcast for close to 5 years, I'm not going to categorically say this was wrong, but anybody out there with any military experience, please let me know if it's realistic to believe that you would take someone off of a naval vessel and send them off on a commando mission. Because that's in essence what you do with John Sheridan. You did really great in this naval engagement. Now we're going to send you on a commando raid.
Interesting.
It's government. It doesn't have to make sense. It's government.
Interesting you put it that way, because that wasn't what I thought that they did. I thought the way the humans approached it was, hey, look, these guys know who you are because of what you did. And so hopefully that gives you a small smidgen of respect, because God knows none of us have any. You know, we've got our ass kicked.
Okay, that's not a bad way to look at it, Brett. I never thought of it that way.
You know, so that's the way I thought they were doing it.
I can see that. I can see that. I also did like the bit with Franklin, where, you know, he's touring the hospital with all the other interns and doctors, whatever, and here comes the general just storming up. What the hell is wrong with you?
I mean, that was...
what I loved about that was it was something that wasn't really talked about huge during the series, right? There was only a couple times where it was ever mentioned that during the war he kind of sat it out, right?
Yeah.
And so if you don't remember those few scenes where that was ever mentioned, you kind of forget about it. So here for those people who really remember, they tell you, and you get to see it. And I liked that.
That was one of the good things about the movie in general, is even if you were a new fan or an old fan, there was something. It kind of set it up for the new fans of TNT, but for the old fans like us, you know, stuff like that and these other little bits really, you know, made that other stuff not so bad. You know, when they do that.
It, of course, it did once again point to another huge retcon issue where, you know, you'd think that Sheridan and Franklin would kind of remember each other getting bombed. I mean, unless you got knocked unconscious and lost your memory for those few minutes or those months of your life.
Jakar is a common Narn name like Jones is for people.
Right? Right? I mean,
you know,
that was frustrating. Oh, I will agree.
You can't be the same Jakar, because I've run into 147 Jakars. Look, oh, here's the phone.
And you don't want to be that guy who says all Narns look the same, right? You don't want to be that guy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, let me ask you this then. How did the newbie do when we saw both of the Kosh?
Well, see, I mean, both when the Koshes the Kosh brothers show up. See, that's stuff that was good because it's not retconning. That's the good stuff that fills in some of the backstory, which I really liked. I liked the stuff with Dukat. I liked the stuff with Delenn and the Vorlons. And Jeffrey, let me ask you this, because this is, to me, probably the epitome of your performance, how you were in both costumes at the same
Dude,
time.
That's impressive.
That was. I was
seriously,
amazed.
Was that split screen shooting? You know, where you have one, you have to stay on one side of the line, and they reshot it with you.
Not only that, Summer, but I was also the guy who I used the camera. I
and
set
was the boom guy
for it. I wrote that part of the story. Joe let me write a portion of the story. And I was also the sound recording guy. I did my own makeup and drove myself to work that day.
Wow.
Dude, you have talent.
It's the reason that I'm rich, famous, and doing the podcast now.
That was pretty impressive.
That wasn't really true. No, there's another alternate universe that you didn't explore there, Summer, and it was that there was another actor in the suit. And that there was
Say it ain't so, Joe.
I know, call me crazy. I know, smoke and mirrors, and here we are doing
okay,
all that
so
Hollywood.
No,
I got it. I got it. It's the Kosh brothers, and they're on a mission from God.
Wait a second. They look like angels. I thought they are God.
Hey.
So that's awesome. So
we have a full tank of gas, half a pack of smokes, and we're wearing encounter suits on our head.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know.
So well, let me ask you this, Jeffrey. On given that
don't say on a serious note.
I almost did, and then I realized the folly of that. Yeah. Two things for you. Which outfit were you in?
I was in the original Kosh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now here's the
Kosh Classic and
Kosh Prime.
our good friend Floyd was in the
new Kosh.
Yeah, he was in Diet Kosh. Right, exactly.
Kosh Zero.
Yeah, exactly. As Russ and I have told you in the past, operating the original Kosh was unwieldy and difficult, and the climbing into the new Kosh Lite was considerably easier and far more manageable and something that almost anyone could get away with.
Yeah, but hadn't Kosh Lite been blown up at that point?
Yeah.
Well,
was that
don't believe everything you see on TV.
Wow. Okay, then. You're giving away all the state secrets on that one, brother.
Yeah. After 200 episodes, I've been holding back, not letting you know what's really going on.
You got to leave something to movie magic, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Here, check this out. Brett, turn this on here. I'm doing the whole Kosh Disco thing.
The funny thing is, I am on you. There it goes. So, you know, it's interesting. Speaking of the whole... Delenn and the guy who plays who was that guy who plays Dukat? Who was that guy? He was German, I think, right?
Reinhold. He was a very nice man.
Holy cow, what a great job he did! But one of the things I loved about that was you heard the things that he told her. Right, yeah. You heard those things, and then if you were a fan of the show, you heard those same things she said to Lanier.
Yeah,
right. So here you got to see where she learned it, and the fact that it wasn't one of those things she just heard, but she absorbed and she used.
Yeah,
and it was great. It was great to see that for me.
It has been passed down.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I have never known the truth or did Delenn to speak when it was convenient.
There you go.
That's right.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. From an origins story, if you want to call it that, I thought it was, screw the retcon piece of it. It was just, it just answered so many, it answered so many questions for me.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's almost a shame that the retcon stuff had to come along. I wish there was a way that you know, that could have been avoided, because otherwise it's a strong piece. The, you know, and I think the brilliance of it is that it gets wrapped around with this future, quote unquote, future element of Londo, obviously in his last hours, as we know from War mm-hmm. Without End,
right.
Fans having watched the show since in the beginning. And the tragedy and the pathos of Londo's situation comes through at every moment. And at the end, you know, when the, you know, is that the kids are asking, is that the story? It's like the story never ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was saying, I mean, literally this thought just came to me. This movie solidifies Londo as the narrator of the main arc
of
the story that we got. From the moment where he says, for 5 minutes, you're the emperor, what do you want?
I love that. He did far better with that question than I did.
Oh my God. Was that not the best? Was that not the best right there when you sit there, what do you want? And that's what. And,
yeah.
No, that line where he says, he did far better with that question than I did, there's more story in that one line than in entire episodes of other series.
You're absolutely right. Although this, I will say that whole scene, though, solidified to me that child actors generally suck. Sorry, whoever you are, guy, because I know this is like 10 years later. Whoever you are, dude, sorry, but you sucked in that episode.
But something dawned on me. What if, in the process of telling a true story, the part we think are really bad retcons are just stuff Londo made up to fill the space? Because he put himself in there at a couple of key places, you know, taking responsibility, taking blame for some of the things that happened that could have ended the Minbari Wars sooner. How much of that is the unreliable narrator?
I don't. You know what? I didn't take it that approach.
Sorry, Chuck. What were you going to say?
Oh yeah, because if you think of the whole story as being through the eyes of Londo, then yeah, maybe you could look at that like that, where he's trying to
just a couple parts of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting though, because quite honestly, you could look at it like, was he trying to make himself look important? Or was he trying to sit there and show, these are my failings? I mean, because if it's me and I'm telling the story, I'm going to make myself look as good as I can.
That's his deathbed confessional.
Yeah, he was trying to set, you know, right. to show them, here are the consequences of actions you take. You learn something from mine. Now, whether he threw a few extra ones in there because he could, I don't know. But what if some of the spaces that we have questions about is stuff where he filled in the blanks with intel that he didn't have all the information about?
You know, I hear what you're saying, Summer, and from a logical point of view, I can understand that. But from an emotional point of view, from a storytelling point of view, I can't buy it, because the whole point of this, I mean, really, in a sense, the whole point of the story is for Londo to leave a legacy other than what his apparent legacy is, which is the destruction of Centauri Prime. You know, at the end, when he tells the kids, you'll remember this story, you'll remember me, he's impressing upon them, it's almost the oral tradition. He's saying, here is this story, here is a true story, you guys have to remember this because this is important information going forward.
The majority of it is what they will remember. They will remember he warned the humans not to get involved with the Minbari before they were ready. He had a hand in trying to disrupt what he thought was an arms deal. But after that, how do we know he knows what happened? We get the story of Battle of the Line, which is glorious and saddening at the same time, because you are literally on the brink of the destruction of an entire species, an entire civilization, and at the last minute, to use a metaphor, God blinked and everything stopped.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because here's the thing, Summer. As great a storyteller as J. Michael Straczynski is, I don't think that was a device he was employing in this case.
I'd agree.
From a gut level, I don't think the retcons. Well, let me put it to you this way: to try to make the retcons work by explaining them away as the fallible narrator, to me, seems like a cheat. And generally speaking, J. Michael Straczynski as a writer is not a cheat.
I would agree.
And so that's why, to me, those things stick out as a thumb. And that's the problem I have. I know we'll get into it, but to touch on it, that's one of the problems I have with Third Space. Third Space is this big, huge, honking thing, and smacked in the middle, you know, right at the end of the Shadow War and the beginning of the Earth Civil War. And it's, again, something that big, nobody's going to mention it at any other point in time except this 1 2-hour movie. It's the same kind of thing. Straczynski wanted to tell his tale. It's the proto-George Lucas. It's really the story he might have wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Or maybe it was an opportunity. He knew, okay, you know, well, yeah, this is to catch up viewers who are completely unfamiliar with Babylon 5, and they won't know us anyways.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's not to say it's a glib thing to say, well, you know, screw the fans who've been here with me for 4 years. You know, I'm changing the story. I just think he got caught up in telling this particular tale. Plus, how do I get all these characters involved that people are going to see in this show? All right, well, you know what? You're going on a top secret mission. And
well, how much of that do you think may have been TNT, like, requiring that they needed something?
I don't think much, honestly. And the reason I say that is I have to believe, as a fan, I have to believe that J. Michael Straczynski said, this is my arc, this is where I'm going, this is what I'm doing, and if you love me, love my show.
Well, I don't think Joe is quite that, I don't want to say hard line, but, you know, because when you...
You don't?
As you read through things like the script books, I mean, he stuck by his guns. You know, he basically produced the show he wanted. But I think he was also aware of, you know, when you read about those TV movies in general, especially once you get to Third Space, River of Souls, Call to Arms, one of the things he had to balance out was telling a story and which actors you leave out and which actors you include and make sure that generally everybody's treated fair. Well, you're not getting a role in this particular one, but we got you in the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So Jeffrey, do you have any insight on that? I mean,
I'm curious.
You know, you weren't necessarily the fly on the wall, but...
No, relative to what TNT tried to, how they tried to steer things, I have no access to that information. And I'm not sure that they... We were on a tear then, so I wouldn't suspect that they gave, Joe any specific direction or things that they were trying to do for the purpose of promoting. Although I won't say that those conversations didn't happen, but Joe was a smart guy and knew how to satiate his client and still stay true to his story. So,
right.
I believe that. I totally believe that. Here's the thing, right? Yeah. With Third Space and some of the other movies that they had out there. Those to me were things that just happened in the universe as versus in the beginning, which was, I mean, something that was, it was the prequel. It was the story that got you where you started. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense or not.
And I think in some ways it definitely succeeded. All the stuff with Delenn and Ducat are brilliant examples of that. As the Earth Minbari War plows on, and even the warrior cast is becoming weary of that battle, I like that stuff too, because again, there was nothing in there that contradicted anything that had gone before. And in fact, one of the things I thought was most impressive was the way in which they worked in, lack of a better term, archival footage from previous episodes,
yep.
And it was very, very seamless.
That's what I loved about it when I said earlier that it fit well. Screw the retconning. If you looked at it from that perspective, it really fit. You could sit there and see. You could see that J. Michael Straczynski had a master plan, and this was part of it.
All right. Well, what else can we say about this thing?
I don't know. I think we've bludgeoned this one to death.
A little bit. No, we got a few things to
talk about. Yeah, you guys could go on and on. It's a 2-hour special.
You know what? I really could, because I absolutely loved this episode. I could go on forever about it, but I won't do it. And I can't call it an episode. It was a movie.
It was a movie. I'm going to throw it out there for the people to call in voicemails about it. How do you feel about squeezing 3 years of a bloody intractable war into 2 hours? And that should get us started. I'm sure Gary is speed dialing right now.
Dial away, brother.
Dial away, Gary.
We could use it.
Yep.
All right. We'll take a quick break and come back with a couple emails.
Friday Fables by Barry J. Northern, a weekly flash fiction podcast. Each week, we explore morals relevant to modern life, such as climate change, celebrity, and work-life balance. But the river only led to the inhospitable sea, and though some had always said they could live there, they found they could not, as well as classic timeless proverbs. But Father, do you not say too many cooks spoil the broth? Well, yes, but don't I also say many hands make light work? Our fables also explore the rich diversity of the animal kingdom, from blackbirds to orangutans, sea stars to weaver ants. And as we learn about their real-world behaviours, their lives become a speculative lens through which we may see ourselves more clearly. Friday Fables, modern fables in the ancient tradition. Find us in iTunes and at barryjnorthern.blogspot.com.
And we are experimenting with new technology, because that's what we do out here on the rim.
We're way past the rim at this point.
We are dancing on the head of a pin, and even the angels are starting going, what the hell is that? This is a voicemail video?
This is a video voicemail from Gary, of course, because Gary is our ultimate fan.
Who will
send in whatever we tell him. And remember many months ago when we said we were experimenting with video and we are now ready for video voicemail? Well, the next day I had a video voicemail from Gary.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Asked for it.
We asked for it. Here it is.
Yep. There it is.
And
okay. So if you're on the video feed, you'll actually be able to see it. But for now, enjoy enjoy what it is.
Summer looks a lot like an Apple laptop. Her being able
to actually have telekinesis. I was discussing it with a few friends the other day, and the point that they brought up was, what about the time when she actually shorted out the camera in the security cell? Obviously, she had to be tampering with actual physical equipment at this point, so it sounds to me like it's pretty good, well, I don't know if reason, but definitely an example of where she actually did affect physical objects, so she must possess some type of telekinesis. I wouldn't think mental brainwaves could short out equipment. Well, that's my 2 cents. Take care, guys.
Oh,
well,
okay. that didn't work
at all.
It worked ish.
Yeah,
ish. No. Ish. I heard him fine.
I heard Gary just fine.
Yeah, we could hear it. I couldn't see the picture until he was done talking, and now the picture's playing.
Well, that's because you're watching it while you're Skyping. That's not fair.
Okay.
We'll figure this out, folks.
The people that are watching the video, it's fine for them.
We promise. Otherwise, drink more Jack Daniels with us,
yes,
and you won't care.
It'll all look the same.
It'll all work out in the end.
So go ahead, Tim. Comment on our first video email.
Well, first, let me say this. If it was a video voicemail, wouldn't that really make it like a face mail?
Ah, I like it.
Man, don't hurt
very,
my head like that.
It's very confusing.
It is, isn't it? It's totally confusing.
Yeah, we have to create new nomenclature there. To Gary's point, I think we've seen telekinesis before. you know, in Byron's group.
Yep.
I think Lita was just, you know, the Vorlons had manipulated her abilities to the point where she was everything. You know, she was as she said, she's the doomsday weapon.
You know, it's interesting. What was the guy? Lionheart? Remember him?
Ironheart.
Ironheart.
Yeah. That was from season one? Wasn't he in season one? Go ahead, sorry.
No, go. Yeah, your point.
No, I was just saying is, I mean, he was telekinesis. He was tele everything, as I recall. I mean, he was. I mean, that was our real first exposure to it, wasn't it?
Right, and Ironheart had been manipulated by Psycor, and that was, I guess, if you want to say, a problem with it. It was that the core didn't quite know what they were doing, so. You know, it was manifesting itself in dangerous ways, and, you know, ultimately he got all Star Trek-y and evolved into a different higher being. But he also, see, here's the other thing. He seemed to have imparted some telekinetic ability to Talia.
And here's my question, and I never got a good answer. Did he impart it to Talia, or did he impart that to the personality who was in control of Talia?
Yes.
Was it? I mean, is that you, Summer, who thinks that? Or is it like the general consensus out there? Because, right, there was Talia that we all knew, but then there was the personality who actually controlled Talia. And, you know, were they the one and the same? Did that ability follow?
So, I mean, now you're talking, I don't know about multiple personality disorder. You know, but the, you know, is it the kind of thing that one personality is able to perform, you know, play piano, and a different personality can't? Is it because there's some block in there? I mean, is that how? I don't know. I'm not enough of a scientist to even be able to guess to know whether or not, you know, if you learn a particular skill.
I believe there has been some. What was it? Research on different, you know, split multiple personalities, some having different memories, different abilities. But we established in season 5 that a split personality telepath can be two different levels.
Yes, that's right. Right.
Good point. Exactly. You're absolutely right.
So I was
so there's no guarantee that the implanted personality, the Bureau 13 personality. That was in Talia would have retained the knowledge of or the ability to control the telekinesis that the surface Talia had.
Right. I'm operating under the fact that the real Talia was the one that Ironheart gave the ability to. The awakened Talia, the suppressed personality, the sleeper personality, didn't have access to that, which is why Bester threw out that little tidbit to get Bobby riled.
Dissection.
Dissected. Right.
Yeah, on his desk or something like that, as I recall, was the exact line. Right?
Well, no, Bester actually said, and, you know, and we examined.
Right. Right.
Debriefing. Yeah, her dissection. Yeah,
debriefing. Yes.
Yeah, that was beautiful. That was beautiful. That was good stuff, you know. But I would say that, and I'm kind of with you, Summer, that the one personality had no idea what the other one could. That didn't translate across.
I always thought them as two separate people. It was they made them so different.
They did, but the one was clearly aware of the other, right? Yeah. The sleeper personality was clearly aware of Talia.
Whereas it's almost Talia, like the sleeper personality was her main personality. It's very ironic that way. You know, the sleeper personality seemed to know everything, but yet she was always in the dark.
Right.
Ooh, good way to put that. Yeah, yeah.
In the chat room here, the EMS boys is saying that Talia's control kept the enhancements. Who do you think took Lita out during the telepath war? And Storm Knight, you know, says most likely she could have evolved or become a Vorlon failsafe.
Interesting.
Talia?
Not.
No, yeah. I would think Talia at that point would have been in the hands of the Psycor, and they would have been doing all kinds of monkey things with her.
I would have thought she'd have been long dead before that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would have thought that she was in parts and pieces long before the telepath war ever started. So
go ahead. And the implication that I've read somewhere is that Leta actually dies in the telepath war. It's a case of but it's like it's a self-sacrifice thing. It's not that it's not like
she did it for the greater good. The
right, exactly.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember that. So
the great thing about her character, you were never really sure which one was. That's what made her interesting like that.
Which would tell
you? Yeah.
You never knew which one was going to end up being the dominant one, you know?
Right.
You guys totally have lost me now because the idea of doing monkey stuff to Talia is just, those are pictures in my head. I cannot stop.
You're welcome.
All right, so now that we've bludgeon poured Gary's video comments to death, do we have anything else?
I've got an email here for you. This comes to us from Mark Cartwright. He says... he writes, I just started listening to the podcast about 6 months ago, and I love it. I work in corporate events and had a couple of things of interest for you. On the biannual press tours for the TV industry in January, I got a chance to talk with John Copeland, who was there for a National Geographic press conference. He took the time to talk B5 and the podcast with me for almost a half hour. A warmer, more generous person would be very hard to find in that industry. Second, on February 27th, John Flynn received the Career Achievement in Television Award from the American Society of Cinematographers. Nice. Since I was only helping with equipment on this show, I did not know until after the show when I saw the program. Program mentioned his groundbreaking work on Babylon 5 as well as Hawaii 5-0, Jake and the Fat Man, Hill Street Blues, Magnum P.I., Gilmore Girls, and Saving Grace. Quite the career. Mm-hmm. Mark, thanks for that information. Wow, John Flynn's an old guy then.
Wow.
You stepped over the line there, but...
well, Hawaii 5-0, come on.
There's
now.
A whole bunch of old guys ready to kick your ass now.
Yeah, way to go, dude. I'm sorry, who did that email come from?
A gentleman named Mark Cartwright.
Mark Cartwright.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Does it ring the bell? Ring bells?
Well, I'm old and drunk, so...
I'm not quite as old, but as drunk.
I don't know.
it's a prerequisite for doing this show.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. So, no, that's great news. Congratulations to John.
Absolutely. John Flynn. No one nicer in the business. And
here,
and
I'll do it.
Yay, there you go.
Absolutely.
Hey. He also directed a couple episodes of...
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did.
He did.
B5. And if I recall the story right... Jeffrey, you might be able to corroborate this, but I recall reading something that Joe had written. Part of what got the show sold to TNT was that they would shoot in 6 days rather than seven. Mm-hmm. And John told Joe there was no way we can do it. And Joe said, well, let's try it once and see what happened. And Straczynski's comment was that John could have very easily sandbagged the thing, but he said he went out there, worked like a trooper, and they they shot the show in 6 days.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know of the specific conversation that took place. I wasn't privy to that. But the sentiment of Joe about John is valid. There was no stopping the man, and he would do whatever we had to do to get it all done. And we always, almost always, we were like on time. Like we just inherently did not have long running days and double overtime and double chocolate covered overtime and all these other things, that can happen, in a show environment. So no, it was amazing what we created in 12 hours every single day. Boom, 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 boom.
Awesome. Very awesome, and we appreciate that. So I think, what do we got? Was that the last?
That's it.
That was it?
That's it, yep.
Wow. Yep.
Nice.
Very nice.
The voicemail phone number has been popping up on screen. That's a new addition. That's nice.
In fact, while we're sitting here, I'll throw it out there one more time, and it'll cover your face, and that's all good.
Oh!
I'm going to write it down so I can call y'all in.
You got a face made for a Vorlon suit, Jeffrey.
And the most important thing that people need to realize, if you're not watching the video feed, you're missing Summer and Tim. Because Summer and Tim are making video appearances on this show.
Yes, they.
She looks like an Apple laptop.
Don't spoil the damn surprise,
dude.
We didn't bring you on to spoil the surprise.
Really? And next year there's gonna be no Santa Claus.
And
I mean, really?
And the Easter Bunny too? You're gonna stomp all over the Easter Bunny?
We are trying very hard to maintain the illusion. I mean, fact that Summer is really an AI living in the internet. I kicked Lawnmower Man's ass. This is my damn thing.
She's that movie with Al Pacino a few years back that nobody saw but me. Simone.
Summer does exist out there if you do the
Lawnmower
searches.
Lawnmower Man.
Ooh, yeah. She is out there if you do the searches.
I've seen the searches.
Go to the Lurkers guide, and you'll see Summer's name there, and it'll say that she's animatronic.
I saw her at Disney once.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Hall of Summers.
There you go.
All right. Get us out of here, Summer.
We're done.
Get us out of here.
If you want to check out our new friends, Sci-Fried, their website is sci-friedband.com. Go over there, give them a little love and support. They will be at MegaCon in Orlando.
That's right.
Is that the one? If you're in the Orlando area, Gary, go check it out.
That's the only show that you can just walk in with your ID and just, like, party. So there please you go. Show up.
Our website is BabylonPodcast.com. Feel free to come by, add your comments. The FarpointForums.com is where our bulletin boards are. The Ustream, the link to the live video information is at our website under the Listen Live link. And to call in a normal, standard, regular voicemail, that number...
What?
Crazy talk.
Oh, my God. They still do that?
Yes, it is. 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259. You got me distracted.
Read the website.
I don't have it in front of me, but yes, 2259.
That's the year that this newfangled technology came upon us all.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the end of the beginning, or it's in the beginning of the end, or...
In the middle of the beginning of the end.
Middle of the end of the beginning.
Yeah, whatever.
And I feel fine.